Well, welcome to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club for Monday, December 1st, 2014. Thank you, everyone, for joining us here today in San Francisco. I'm John Zipperer, the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, and your host for Week to Week. On today's program, we will look at what happens next following the recent elections, including the intrigue it's creating within the parties. We'll check into the political actions concerning the events in Ferguson, Missouri, and President Obama's use of executive actions. As usual, any opinions expressed up here are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. So let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage there with Bill Whalen. He's a research fellow at Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's also a political blogger at adayattheracesblog.com. Joining our week-to-week panel for the first time is Scott Schaefer, host and reporter at the California Report and a senior correspondent for KQED Newsroom. And Carla Marinucci next to me. She's the senior political writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. All of them are on Twitter, where you can follow them. So please use the question cards that are spread throughout the room. I will try to ask as many of those questions as possible during this program. Now on to our program, or on to the roundtable, excuse me. And I want to start with the post-election fallout effects, the importance, what happened in the state. We had what was probably one of the most boring governor races in a long time, but some interesting things did happen in this election. Republicans did not do as well in California as they did nationally, but they did score some successes. So let's look at what this election says, for example, about the GOP's efforts to rebrand itself and to hopefully they want to start growing again within the state. Carla, I want to start with you. You recently reported that former GOP gubernatorial candidate Tim Donnelly, who's on their party's conservative wing, he said Republican leaders, quote, have taken the grand old party and turned it into the moderate wing of the Democrat Party, unquote. So what did he mean by that, and how is that being received in Republican circles?
Well, you know, I mean, look, the Tea Party folks like Tim Donnelly on the right might be a little bit upset at the way things turned out, but the fact is the Republicans do have some things to celebrate in this election. For one, they got rid of the Democrats' supermajority in both houses of the state legislature. The Democrats could, just in the past 2 years, pass taxes without a single Republican vote, put a constitutional amendment on the ballot without a single Republican vote. Now that's gone. Now that means everybody's got to be a little more moderate, whether Tim Donnelly likes it or not. And I think a lot of people think that's a good thing for the state. But, you know, look, Republicans had some wins that they, I think, can be proud of. And the fact is that they did elect some moderate Republicans. Let's take Catherine Baker, East Bay Assemblywoman. She got sworn in today, and this is a very big win for the Republicans. She's a pro-choice Republican lawyer from, she's the only Republican legislator in the Bay Area at this point, and that is a sort of a watershed moment for the Republicans. And they elected in the South three Asian American legislators, including the first Vietnamese American, Janet Nguyen, three women. That is a dynamite force, but it also shows that the Republican Party in California has made real gains on the Asian vote, and that is going to be something to watch in the future here in California.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this year is the 20th anniversary of Prop 187, which is often pointed to as the beginning of a long slide for the Republican Party in California, and I think rightly so. And I think we may look back, perhaps, at the election of this year as the year that they turned it around or began to turn it around. Jim Brulte, the party chair, understood that they needed to rebrand themselves to appeal to a wider audience, to have candidates who look like the people they're trying to represent. And that's why I think you see in Orange County, where three of those women, Asian women, were all elected down there. And he understands that that's really their route back. And not necessarily starting at the top. I mean, the Republican Party didn't put much into Neel Kashkari. In fact, two of the statewide or GOP nominees didn't even endorse him. So I think that they realize that they're not going to throw good money after bad, but they're going to focus down ticket, local races, city council races, the mayor. They're very happy that the Republican won in San Diego, Kevin Faulkner. And so they're trying to build on those things, and I think that's smart. Instead of going for the Hail Mary pass and find, you know, a Meg Whitman who can self-finance the campaign and go up, but then go down in flames. And I think so. I think it's a good strategy for them. And it seems, you know, in this election, I think you can say it paid, like Carl said, some dividends.
Right. So politics is ultimately a numbers game, and here's the number, the numerical reality for Republicans who are a 28% proposition in California and shrinking in about two or three more cycles. There'll be more independents in California than there are Republicans. You saw Catherine Baker win over in the East Bay. This was a race that had about 120,000 votes in it, all said and done. Democrats had about a 7% advantage in registration. So what you saw is in a race of about that size, where you run a good Republican candidate. Also, the Democratic candidate was not very strong. He was a political director of CTA, right? And she had a very good issue on her side in the BART strike. Republicans can win at that level. But what you saw is when you're a 28% party, you can't go any higher in California. There were four House seats in particular Republicans targeted, one in Sacramento, one in San Diego, one in the Central Coast, and then one in Fresno. Republicans lost each and every one of those districts. Why? Because instead of 120,000 votes, these races had about 190,000 to 200,000. Then you go to the statewide level, where the closest Republican was about 350,000 votes away. So if you think of the Republicans as evolution, if you will, except Republicans believe in evolution, but the idea of man looking to walk upright, Republicans are in sort of a hunched-over position right now where they can win targeted legislative races. So in 2016, there are two goals for them. Number one, the Baker race is the race to watch in California in 2016. Forget the Senate race, which we'll get to in a few minutes. Forget the ballot props. This is the race to watch in California because Democrats will come at her hammer and tongs to take that back. And then the question is, can Republicans move the next step up and win targeted congressional races? But this is a long build for the GOP. It is easily a 10-year project, I'd estimate.
I just want to add, you know, although you're right, they did, those three Democrats held on sort of by the skin of their teeth, Ami Barra and Jim Costa and Brownlee, right, down in the Central Coast. But, you know, they also picked up an open seat in the Inland Empire. Pete Aguilar, the mayor of Redlands, got elected. That was a seat they should have won last time, and they kind of screwed it up by having too many Democrats split up the vote. So there was actually a net gain of one for the Democrats in California congressional delegation, which I don't know how many states you can point to where that happened.
You know, and I think one other significant thing when we talk about demographics, changing demographics in California and the Asian vote, one of the issues that drove the vote both in the Orange County races and in Catherine Baker's race was SCA5, which was the effort to end the ban on affirmative action in the public universities. This was an issue that was raised by some Hispanic legislators and African American legislators, Democrats in the state legislature, and Asian American voters hated this, and it fired them up. I went to rallies in the East Bay where there are very few Republicans, and these are Republican rallies where they were almost entirely Asian, and this is a population that has voted 70% and upwards for the Democratic Party, and they are being courted very strongly now by Republicans, and that is going to be, I think, something to watch here in California.
You think that topic is one that the Republicans will try to mine then? More, Bill?
If you go back to the genesis of Proposition 209, which was the end of racial quotas in universities and public hiring, it was Asian families that really started the drumbeat because Asian families numerically were getting the short end in Berkeley and the UC system. So this is why SCA5, your heart may be into affirmative action, but from a political standpoint, if you're a Democrat, this is not smart politics because you are now driving a wedge within your base between African-Americans, Latinos, and Asians, and Republicans will take full advantage of that.
Well, I think that, you know, Democrats dropped that hot potato, and I don't think they're going to probably pick it up again. I mean, that would make it easy for the Republicans to use it, but I don't know.
They would pick it up if they had a supermajority in the legislature.
They do.
Well, let's go into that some more. The supermajority, Carla mentioned it, you just mentioned it now. What does that really matter? I mean, it wasn't a dramatic change in votes.
There were issues that the Democrats would have had, let's say, a much easier time with. A shift in Prop 13, a reconfiguration of Prop 13, the so-called split roll, where the business or the commercial taxes are sort of recalculated. Polls have showed that a lot of voters support that idea, but Governor Brown has kind of kept a distance from that. Prop 13 has been sort of the hands off, and the Democrats could have gone for it with the supermajority. Now it's going to be much tougher, and now we're hearing that maybe we're going to see a ballot measure on this. This is going to be, I think, a big fight, don't you think, in terms of the...
Yeah, potentially. Although, you know, as you pointed out when we were talking earlier, the threshold now to get something on the ballot is lower because it's based on the turnout of the last gubernatorial election, so it does make it easier to get something on the ballot.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
That means the number of signatures that propositions need to qualify is lower.
Based on the turnout in the governor's race, I think it's 8% is needed for... signatures to get something on the ballot. Is it 5%
for initiatives and 8% for constitutional amendments?
Yeah. Because the turnout was so low in the last election, it is now relatively cheap to get something on the ballot. I think it's 300,000 signatures for a ballot measure and 500,000 for constitutional. That's inexpensive.
But even, you know, I think that it's one of those issues. Of course, it's much easier to get people to vote no on a ballot measure, and I think the fiddling around with Prop 13, no matter what the polling might show now, theoretically, when you put something specific on the ballot and you start, you can just imagine the campaign against it. It's going to be very well funded.
It does, and I think the person who's happiest with this setup of having a majority of Democrats but not a supermajority is one Jerry Brown.
I agree.
With that.
The reason, Jerry, we've learned a lot of things about Governor Brown in the second go-round in the governor's office, one of which is he's not necessarily a social warrior. He's not really somebody beholden to the left or the right. He likes to paddle left, paddle right, as he says. And the last thing he wants is a lot of two-thirds bills sent his way, changing Proposition 13, or another one which would be extending Proposition 30, which is the tax increase which he passed in 2012. There's an open question. It starts to go off the books in 2016. It goes fully away in 2018. There is a divided opinion in Sacramento as to what to do. The governor has said he thinks it's temporary. It should go away. There are lawmakers who think it should be extended for another 4 or 5 years because without Prop 30, your surplus in Sacramento becomes a deficit very fast. And there's another group of thought that it should be extended, made permanent. This takes away the legislature's ability to draft such a bill and send it to the governor and force his hand. Instead, the governor can decide what he wants to do and when he wants to do it. And by the way, this is a governor who's sitting on about $15 million. And what did he do a week after the election? He went out and held a fundraiser. So he's going to have about $20 million in the bank with money burning a hole in his pocket, unless he's running for another office we don't know about. And what will he do with it? At some point, he will decide he'll do something big and ambitious on the ballot, and he'll have $20 million to spend.
Well, it's interesting, Jerry Brown, like, you know, he really didn't do much of, he didn't really lift very many fingers for anybody else. You know, he didn't help anybody down ballot very much. I think he maybe attended one event for one candidate, Tim Sobrandy over in the East Bay, I think. Mayor of Oakland, he helped. But in terms of the legislature, to your point, Bill, I agree. I don't think he really wanted a two-thirds, a bulletproof majority up there. You know, so he's, very happy having enough Democrats, but not too many.
But this is the new reality of Sacramento, by the way. I worked in Sacramento 20 years ago when dinosaurs roamed the earth. And back then, you needed a two-thirds majority to pass a budget, plain and simple. And each year, the budget was a hellish experience because you'd have about 5 Republicans who had to cross over and sign with the Democrats. And there was fierce horse trading. It would go into overtime. It would get very ugly. Now you just need a majority to pass the budget. So Republicans are irrelevant to the process, and so are about 10 or 15 Democrats as well. So that's easily done. But if you don't have the two-thirds majority, you cannot increase taxes, and you cannot pass initiatives that you're so choosing. So again, for Governor Brown, this is really the ideal place to be.
Well, you know, I would say, too, that Democrats have become a little more conservative, too. You've got a lot of these business Democrats who really kind of go both, you know, back and forth depending on the issue. They get a lot of money from business, and so they're not necessarily super environmentalists, not necessarily...
Well, some of the Democrats, one Democrat from Fresno is leading the charge with regard to cap and trade to exempt fuels, oil and gas from the cap and trade. And that's the kind of moderation you're going to see up there now.
Yep, absolutely. And so, I don't think a two-thirds, the unity can't be necessarily dependent on.
They've been restrained. They haven't had money to spend. They haven't had a huge surplus to spend. When there's money to spend, people get a lot more ambitious and your true colors start to come out. So if the economy takes off in the next couple of years, you'll see a lot more ambitious spending ideas. And this will put the governor in a kind of a push and pull situation vis-a-vis lawmakers. He loves that reputation to be the cheapest man in town, and he will not let it go.
Just ask Janet Napolitano.
Well, let's talk about some of the future developments that we're going to see. This race is out of the way. Naturally, we start thinking about 2016, 2018. We're probably in the...
Well,
we,
side.
Yes.
That's more than a
Let's handicap the 2020 presidential election right now. Who will go up? No.
Chelsea.
We're in the last term now of Governor Brown. Are we in the last term of our two U.S. senators? And if so, who is likely in both parties to be waiting to jump in there?
To me, this is the funnest parlor game out there is, you know, what happens when the big three finally go? You know, when they finally retire, who are we looking at? And there's a whole host of Democrats just dying to just jump into this. And you could name, you know, of course, Gavin Newsom, Kamala Harris, Dave Jones, the insurance commissioner, Antonio Villaraigosa, Eric Garcetti. Keep going, guys. I mean, there's a list.
Betty
Yee. Probably Betty Yee. I mean, at this point, the question is who doesn't run? But, you know, we even saw some of the impacts. You know, we've talked about this before, what's been called this gerontocracy in the Democratic Party that has kind of kept a lot of the younger generation from moving up. Mark Leno sort of has this issue here in San Francisco where a lot of people think he'd be the natural choice if Nancy Pelosi would ever retire.
Well, you know, as we saw in the South Bay, Ro Khanna thought, you know, people were tired of Mike Honda. That turned out not to be the case, although he came fairly close, closer than a lot of people thought. But, you know, he did see Eric Swalwell knock off Pete Stark in the East Bay last time around. So I think there is this kind of, you can just, I think of Gavin Newsom as sort of a thoroughbred, like, behind the gate, you know, waiting for the gate to open, you know. And he so doesn't want to be lieutenant governor anymore, but there's nowhere to go.
A thoroughbred, the fabulous mane of hair. This is actually a serious issue for Democrats in this regard. There's not really a Republican qualified to win a statewide office in 2016 or 2018, in my estimation. Unless there's a billionaire to be named later, there's nobody in office right now. Nobody is going to give up a job in Washington to come out and run in California. So this is really about Democrats. And here's where things are tricky for their party. Gavin Newsom and Kamala Harris appear to be on a collision course, and that's for governor in 2018. They can either run against each other and perhaps advance to a general election against each other, or they could cut each other's throats in the process, destroying one of their careers and having a Democrat in a weak third place, a Republican in a weak third place position, end up in second place by dividing the votes. So the Democrats have to sit down and figure out, okay, there are three seats we're talking about, possibly Barbara Boxer's in 2016, possibly Dianne Feinstein's in 2018, and definitely Governor Brown's in 2018, thanks to term limits. When in doubt, I always go to the Godfather. And the Godfather is the best analogy here because you literally have to have the family sit down at the table, and Tom Hagen or somebody has to kind of broker the peace, and they have to kind of decide the territories. And it begins with all these people looking at 2016, if indeed Boxer does not run. We're all guessing she's not running because she has about $150,000 in the bank, and from what I'm told, she's not talking to her donors and her supporters and showing any indication that she wants to run for another term, which is what you usually do when your party loses after a midterm. So all these people are lined up, and the first seat to look at is United States Senate. For some reason, Democrats seem very gun-shy about the Senate right now. Maybe it's what happened a few weeks ago. Maybe it's the idea of leaving California. Maybe it's the idea that if you go in the Senate, that's not necessarily a national projection, though Barack Obama and Joe Biden would point to that otherwise. But it's kind of the case of a bunch of people lined up and looking for a volunteer, and perhaps everybody's going to take one step back and one person will be left to volunteer. So somebody will emerge as a Senate candidate in 2016, and then the 2018 scenario steps down. And these are serious jobs. We re-elect governors in California. That's a guaranteed 8-year job. And as Boxer and Feinstein have shown, that is a 25-year job you're looking at. So these are not to be dismissed lightly.
And I think there's an assumption that, you know, Kamala Harris would have the leg up in a head-on with Gavin just because in a Democratic primary, even though we have open primaries now, it's not really a Democratic primary. But, you know, there's more women voting. She's done well. Obviously, she's very dynamic. Obama will probably help her.
Interestingly, on a civil rights front.
Yeah. Right. But, you know, it's interesting. Okay, so Kamala Harris barely got elected last time, right, in 2010. It was almost Thanksgiving by the time they figured out who won. And the Republicans couldn't find a credible candidate to run against her this time around.
Yeah,
I mean, Ron Gold came in second. No one knew who he was. Everyone was looking, you know, running to the computer to see who is this guy. And he got, 45% of the vote.
Right. Yeah.
you know, which is way ahead of Republican registration. And so I think she does have some negatives, you know, in a statewide race. That, not to say that if she was running against a Republican, she wouldn't win. But I do think that she's got some damage.
The other thing about Gavin and Kamala is they have the same political consultant right here in San Francisco. And the feeling is that, look, the Democratic Party poobahs are going to sit down with these two and say, we got to come up to it with a deal. Who's going to run for what? Because they have the same donors, the same supporters. This would be a bloodbath. They cannot run for the same spot. And so the good parlor game is, you know, who's better for what position, governor or whatever. But I think that's going to be so interesting. But on the Republican side, I'm curious to hear you say, Bill, that you don't see any potential candidates. What about Ashley Swearingen, the candidate, the mayor of Fresno? A lot of people think she did very well in the controller's race. Obviously, she didn't win, but she was a credible, strong candidate.
400,000 votes in a record low turnout year when her Democratic opponents could not be found advertising on TV. So, I mean, how is she going to...
She won't get donors.
How is she going to turn that around? And if she ran in 2016, 2016 is a bump year in California. There'll be a presidential election. If it's Hillary Clinton, turnout would be much larger than it was in 2014. So I'm the Republican on the panel here, so I shouldn't be the one being grim. But realistically, Republicans are not in a position to win that race.
Yeah. Although, you know, it's fun to... The parlor game is always fun, but I don't think anybody's gotten rich necessarily predicting what's going to happen in politics. You know, you look at President Clinton from 2008, right? I mean, Barack Obama came in and snatched that away, and you just can't really... I mean, there's always an expression that a year is an eternity in politics, much less two. And so while right now it looks like Hillary is, you know... obviously the one to beat, but invulnerable in some ways, which I really just don't buy that.
One more thing though on the statewide races we should mention, and that is, aside from the electeds who may be running, there are people from the tech sector that we are all looking at. One being Tom Steyer, of course, the biggest single donor in the country. He's right here in San Francisco. It gave $76 million to other races elsewhere, which makes me wonder, are Democrats here a little bit angry at him? Like, hey, where was our part of the money? And how come you stepped up to the plate with us here in California? But Steyer is a force, there's no question about it. But then, you know, we've also heard about Sheryl Sandberg. You know, she's a big executive with Facebook. She's probably almost as well known as Mark Zuckerberg. But she has a huge following because of her book, Lean In. John, we've talked about this. She's moderated or spoken at Commonwealth Club events,
several times.
I've been to several of these. Every time, it's the Church of Sheryl Sandberg. These women show up with the book in hand. They have lean-in groups all over the country. She has a base. She's getting her base together.
How many of you read
Lean In? How many of you own it, at least, and haven't read it? Okay. You've heard of it.
I can't imagine her running against Kamala Harris.
Yeah. She's a billionaire. She has as much money as she needs.
Yeah, but how many of those people get elected? I mean, that's the thing.
This is the test, know? I think.
But we learned a lesson in Silicon Valley in particular when Ro Khanna ran against Mike Honda, and there was cool on one side and tech and glamour and prettiness versus old-fashioned union politics.
Yeah.
And guess who prevailed? Old-fashioned union
it's
politics.
It's true. However, he came within about 4 points of Mike Honda, so I think...
Also,
I would not be surprised if he goes back at it again.
I think if Sheryl runs for Congress, she'd have a really good chance. You know, it's harder to run a statewide election. I mean, look at Meg Whitman. You know, I mean, she's never done it before. It's tough.
Let me ask one awesome question here. Why on God's earth does she want to go to Congress?
Probably doesn't. Probably wants to be governor.
She could buy Congress.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Speaking of rich people running for office, there's talk about, you were talking about Republicans who could possibly run, who would have any chance. What's this about Carly Fiorina and a certain office that she might be interested in?
I talked to Carly Fiorina about 2 months ago. She does a number of big charitable things. Of course, you all may remember she ran for Senate in 2010 against Barbara Boxer and came in about 10 points behind. But this year, the buzz is out there that she's running. And I asked her about that, and she said, well, you know, when people keep asking me, and when they ask you, you have to consider doing this, which means, yes, she's going to be running. So what is she doing right now? She's doing all the things a candidate does. She's calling donors. She's starting to put some kind of staff together. She's going to Iowa and New Hampshire. And she started a PAC for women. I think my feeling is she may be sort of angling to be vice president. And if Hillary is on one side, she's the only, this is her sort of resume, the only woman in the race and the only CEO in the race. This is a woman who ran a, you know, Fortune 20 company. She's a major force in business.
Well, there are other Republican women who actually are elected office, like Susana Martinez, who's the...
I doubt she'll run.
No, but for vice president.
For vice president,
you know,
okay.
If you want to balance it, you know, you get a Latina, I mean, that would be nice, too.
I mean, the thing about Carly Fiorina, we've seen her up close here in California because she's run. She also has a couple of black marks she's got to deal with. She has about $500,000 in debt from that race that she never paid off. That's got to be. But then again, she'll be able to raise money. And I think, I have to say, when it came, I followed her around an awful lot in the Senate race. She was a very good candidate when it came to communication skills, and much better than Meg Whitman in terms of getting out the message. And since then, she's been the head of the National Republican Senatorial Campaign. She's a big hit with conservatives. She's going to be a keynote speaker at CPAC coming up. They love her. I mean, you know, it's going to be interesting to watch what she does and whether she's really angling to be president or vice president, I think.
Full disclosure, she is an overseer at the Hoover Institution where I'm employed, but I haven't talked to her about this. She shows every sign of running, mainly by the fact she's not saying no to people like Carla. That's the surest sign you're in. And Carla and Scott are absolutely right. There is a lesson in this, and that's Joe Biden. Joe Biden ran for president in 2008 in part because he was bored sitting in the Senate, but also in part because Joe Biden is a crafty guy at the end of the day, and he thought to himself, if I go out in these debates and I basically do not offend Hillary, I do not offend Barack Obama, I'll get a cabinet job out of this, mark my words. And what he was looking for is to be Hillary's Secretary of State. Now, he guessed wrong on which horse would come in first, but he got an even better job, some would argue, than Secretary of State out of it. So if you're Carly Fiorina, you're probably thinking, okay, there are 13 people running. The Hill, which is a publication in Washington, listed 13. Fox News had a segment on it tonight. They listed 24. On it goes. Scott Schaefer was not on the list, by the way. So she's thinking...
Bill Whelan was.
Yeah, boy, that was a scary thought. So she's thinking, okay, not a woman in the field right now, and assuming Mitt Romney is not running, really nobody who could, you know, hang their hat on business experience, so there's a niche for her. And again, the thinking is this, if I go out on the debate stage and I don't tick off the person who becomes the nominee, you know, there's probably something waiting for me at the end of the day, so why not do it?
She'd be a great Commerce Secretary.
Yeah.
We're throwing out names. Someone in the audience asks, what if Condi Rice were to run for the Senate, given the situation with Russia, China, and ISIS?
Anyone know? Condi's kind of yesterday's news, I think. You know,
I'm not sure about that.
Really?
You know, wherever she shows up, she's extremely popular with crowds. It just seems like she has never expressed interest. Bill, she's another at Hoover. So
she and I talk all the time about this. No, it's hardly a speech goes by where I don't get asked about her political interest. And two things to know. Number one, she has pretty much an idyllic life right now, she would say, in terms of being on the Stanford campus. She is teaching a course at the business school. Speaking of somebody who tried to broker peace in the Middle East, she's now trying to help determine which four teams go in the college football playoff. She's involved in that committee. So she's kind of a masochist in that regard. And she is a golf fiend. She belongs to Augusta and several other clubs. She loves to play golf. I'm not sure she'd want to run for office. I'm not sure if she has the personality that lends itself to going out and making herself available to crowds every day. Remember, it worked for Arnold Schwarzenegger because Arnold, at the end of the day, is just a ham, plain and simple. But she's not. The only scenario I could see for her would be on the ticket in 2016 in this regard. First of all, much like Carly getting something out of running for president, she could sit down with the nominee and carve out a very attractive vice presidency as she would like to do it, run foreign policy and whatever else she'd want to do in the government. And secondly, it would be a very short campaign. Like Arnold running in the recall, which is about a 60-day effort, running for vice president is what, about a 100-120-day grind, if you will. So maybe she would do that. But no, for her to go and sit in the back of the Senate to be a freshman, to be told, you know, how to vote on things by Mitch McConnell, I don't see that.
I thought she really wanted to be NFL commissioner.
Actually, no, okay,
that job may be available.
So I was in a room with her and reporters a few weeks ago, and a reporter said, don't you want to be NFL commissioner? And she looked at the reporter and she said, honey, college football's my game.
Okay, before we get off the state level, let's talk briefly about a couple of the propositions that passed. Scott, Prop 47, why is that significant?
Well, Prop 47 is significant, and it passed easily. It was interesting who supported it in terms of financing it. I think its largest donor was somebody from the Christian Ministries down in Malibu, somebody who got to know Chuck Colson.
This was the criminal justice.
This is the one that reclassified some low-level felonies as misdemeanors. And it not only did that prospectively, but it did it retroactively. So the day after the election, there were people in jail who could petition the courts and are petitioning the courts to have their sentences reduced. And in some cases, even you can go back, and if you committed one of these eligible low-level felonies, you can have it removed. You can have it removed from your record as a felony, so you are no longer an ex-felon.
People are getting out already.
And people are getting out, absolutely. So you have people who were facing, you know, a couple of years or more in prison are now out, or they might have, you know, very much shorter sentences. And so this is what's interesting to me about it is both the coalition from the left and the right that supported it. There was really no campaign against it at all. No, I mean, the police organizations and the DAs were against it, but they didn't raise any money. There were no commercials. And to me, the bigger story is that this is just a chapter in several critical criminal justice reforms that have happened in California, some of which Jerry Brown has initiated, like realignment, which is having the counties now take care of a lot of these low-level, the non-non-nons, non-sexual, non-violent, non-serious offenses. But is it going to work? We've seen three strikes now reformed at the ballot box. We may yet see the death penalty back on the ballot, ending the death penalty narrowly lost. And so I just think there's a lot going on in California now on criminal justice, and we're beginning to see some of these property crime rates ticking up. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, it takes just one realignment probation person to commit a horrible crime, and suddenly the whole thing could collapse. But clearly, not just here, but in California in particular, you know, we're seeing this trend toward a rethinking of crime and punishment and, you know, do we really want to throw away the key? And for young people and others who, you know, maybe should be given a second chance, drug offenders, for example.
I also think on this one, something interesting about it was George Gascon, district attorney, was one of the few in California who supported this one. That, along with his support of the kill switch, cell phones. Makes him somebody to watch as a political candidate in the future.
On something really interesting, and that was really the lack of opposition, public opposition to Prop 47, other than some signatures and protests, no advertising. 20 years ago in California, when we were doing three strikes and one strike and truth in sentencing laws and all this cracking down on offenses, the most potent lobby in Sacramento was the crime victims lobby. These were people who would march to Sacramento, and they'd do very public events. They would put coffins on the lawn of the Capitol, and they would put pressure on the lawmakers to pass these bills. 20 years later now, the crime victims lobby is, if it's still out there, it's really missing in action right now. Maybe what we're looking at is maybe a 20-year cyclical situation in California. The pressure to change laws in the 1990s was brought in part by a lot of laws passed in the 70s, which eased up sentencing, for example, and 20 years later, pressure to change those. And now what we're seeing 20 years after three strikes is moving away from tougher sentencing and reducing.
And some of that is being driven by the court order to reduce the population in the prisons. But, you know, to look at one slice of that population, lifers, there's about 26,000 people serving life in prison with the possibility of parole. And past governors, Republican and Democrat, you know, in California, before somebody gets out, the governor can reverse the recommendation for parole. And Arnold Schwarzenegger reversed 75% of the parole recommendations. Gray Davis reversed 95%. Jerry Brown is allowing 75 or 80% of them to go forward. Mm-hmm. And so you're seeing thousands now of lifers, you know, getting out of prison, assuming they've, you know, been deemed suitable for parole and not a threat to public safety. And that's a huge change, and it's happening kind of under the radar a little bit. I mean, I've reported on it, so it's not that we're ignoring it, but it is not an issue. You know, it's not something you heard about in the governor's race or in the attorney general's race.
But I think if we can segue, if I think at the local level, this is where sort of the rubber meets the road. When we talk about the Oakland mayor's race, somebody lives in Oakland, I know this very well. This issue of crime in Oakland was the single driving factor in that race. The fact that Libby Schaaf was one of 15 candidates, yet sort of distinguished herself by saying, look, we're going to control, I think she said, reduce crime by 80%. Was that her?
She may regret that.
Yeah, she may regret saying that. But the fact is that that issue became the single issue in the race and propelled her.
Jerry Brown's endorsement.
And Jerry really Brown's helped endorsement helped a great deal. But
maybe not the 80%, but I mean, can she dramatically bring down crime? I mean, Oakland has some interesting...
I looked up New York in the 1990s under Giuliani, and he knocked down property crimes by about 65%, so a significant change. But if she wants to take the New York approach to Oakland, this is where it gets really, really fascinating to look at. You want to reduce crime, what's the first thing you're going to do? You're going to hire police. And she said she wants to raise the Oakland police force to about 950 or so, 925, I think. And right now it's around 700 or so. So she's got to find the money to do that and also get these people through the pipeline. It's not like Scott and I are in a bad movie. We become cops tomorrow. It takes about a year and a half to, I don't look, Jonah Hill and Scott Schaefer. It takes about a year and a half to get cops through the pipeline and on the street. And after Ferguson, there'll be a tremendous amount of pressure to have minority police especially. So number one, she's going to have to get more cops on the street and find a way to pay for it. Secondly, if you look at the New York example, they cracked down in particular on misdemeanors, kind of low-level arrests, and they filled up their jails. Their jail space increased by about 25%. Inmates in jails went up by about 25% at a time we're trying to ease prison overpopulation. But then thirdly, to pay for this and make this happen, she's going to need jobs in Oakland. So she's going to have to, first of all, crack down on riots because that is an advertisement by somebody else's chamber of commerce to move businesses elsewhere. And secondly, she's on the record saying that the last thing she wants Oakland to become is another San Francisco. Idea, we're not going to have a bunch of heartless, soulless yuppies come into our town and destroy it. Well, those heartless, soulless yuppies put money into your tax system. So she's got a lot of balls in the air here. I'm trying to figure out how to juggle those.
It's a very delicate thing in Oakland to talk about more cops, but then more sensitive community policing. As someone who lives there, I think, in the hills, I mean, I don't know a single neighbor who hasn't been ripped off or robbed or whatever, and you have these community... Our neighborhood actually hired our own police force. I mean, that's how bad it got for a while. I think things...
Did you carry a gun?
Some of them did carry guns, but, I mean, I don't carry a gun. But, I mean, the fact is that this is an issue. We're going to see whether she can pull off that, plus pension liabilities. There's a whole lot of balls that the Oakland mayor is juggling. I think she'll have the counsel of Jerry Brown, who actually lives in Oakland, jogs in Oakland every day, goes to local businesses on weekends.
She does a bad job in her first term, and the odds of Jerry coming back and unseating her would be...
Oh! It's Jerry Brown, so...
It'll be interesting. I mean, I asked her if she, thought the city needed a new police chief, and of course she wasn't going to answer that. But, that's a symbolic choice, and I wouldn't be surprised mayors often pick their own police chiefs. And, she could try to bring in a Bill Bratton type, somebody who's a star or a rising star among police chiefs.
So you interviewed her.
How's her personality compare and her temperament compared to Jean Kwan's?
Well, Jean Kwan was not a high school cheerleader, as Libby Chauvin. She has a very bubbly personality and persona, but she's also very smart and sharp and articulate and dynamic. I think that Jerry Brown didn't endorse her just for the heck of it. She worked for him. I think she's got a really good head on her shoulders. And we'll see if she can bring people together. I saw this weekend she was at some of the black churches talking about what was happening in Ferguson and also what was happening in Oakland with regard to the unrest there. But I think she's, unlike others who become mayor there, is not as beholden to some of the interest groups because she did kind of come out of nowhere. I mean, she wasn't leading any of the polls before the election, and she really just kind of shot to the top through ranked choice voting with Jerry's help and Barbara Boxer's endorsement as well. So I was very impressed with her, and I think she's serious about governing and serious about policy. Reminded me a little bit in a different way of Eric Garcetti down in Los Angeles, who's kind of a geek. He's really into government working well and metrics and data. I think that's the kind of mayor she wants to be.
But in Oakland, as in the state, I think education, the issue, and we can talk about this when it comes to the university too, this is an issue that is so important to voters. We know that all the techies and hipsters can move into Oakland that you want, but as soon as they start having kids, If those schools aren't good enough, they'll move to Walnut Creek or in San Francisco or someplace else. They've got to improve the schools in Oakland. And that issue, whether it's at the local level or at the university level, matters a great deal to voters. We're going to be seeing some polls this week on that, and whether voters want to raise taxes or whether do they support tuition increases, and I think, no, they do not. So this issue is going to matter to her, but it, on a statewide level, also
it's hard
a great
to
deal.
Turn around schools in 4 years, you know, and take credit for it. You know, I think Villaraigosa figured that out.
And when we talk about issues that Jerry Brown is going to handle on a statewide level, this issue of the tuition increases is like front and center to a lot of middle-class voters in this state. We know that a lot of the students who go to University of California or state colleges get financial aid. Some of them don't need it. The foreign students and so forth pay. But the fact is it's the middle class that's getting slammed with these tuition increases. And that's why it was interesting to watch Jerry Brown come here to San Francisco and go to war with Janet Napolitano.
It's interesting to rarely see a
UC president take on a governor. But she's been a governor, and she's also been, of course, the Secretary of Homeland Security.
Another one, by the way, who's sort of rumored to possibly be a future candidate here in California.
The first thing I thought of when she was appointed UC president, I thought she'd be a great Supreme Court justice here in California or governor. You know, she definitely has that profile.
She's got a little problem with immigration and
deportations.
But that was a throwdown between her and
I think Jerry's going to blink, or the legislature is going to split the difference. I don't think they're going to raise tuition 5% as she's proposing. And I think it was a chess move. And, you know, Jerry Brown loves to play chess, and I think he probably looks down the road a little bit and sees that it's going to be hard to let that happen.
Governor Brown has a big speech coming up, an inaugural address. I think January the 3rd is when he gives it. And then he has a State of the State after that, and he's somebody who's looking for big ideas in his second term because this is what Browns do. There was a fascinating biography on Pat Brown done a few years ago by Kathleen Brown, daughter, Pat Brown's granddaughter, if you can follow the bouncing ball. And there was a line, I think, by Kathleen in the documentary where she says, Pat Brown believed in doing great big things because that's what California governors do. Now, as much as we joke about Jerry Brown being the cheapest man in town and all of that, some of his father's DNA does course through those veins, and he sees doing big things as part of being the governor. That's the only reason why I can think he holds on so tightly to that rail system, for example. He wants to do big things. So if he wants to do something ambitious in his second term, I would point him directly at the University of California system and maybe do something, update the Clark Kerr report from years ago and talk about what the vision is for the UCs in the 21st century, because you have all these collisions going on right now in the UCs. First of all, there's affordability with these tuition increases. There's a question of who gets into the UC system because we've now been cutting away and bringing in more out-of-state students to help balance the books. There's a question of curriculum. There's a question of just general, you know, what job we're pushing students in. And so this would be a great thing, I think, for the governor to wade into.
But what's interesting is that I think the governor and the UC president have fundamentally different views of what the University of California should be. You know, Janet Napolitano talks about continuing the tradition, competing in a way or being on par with the private schools like Stanford. And Jerry Brown says, why? Why do we need to do that? Why do we need to pay chancellors, you know, $475,000? Why don't we, you know, focus on CSU, for example, and getting kids into that track? They don't need to go to UC.
I think he made a point very strongly when he said, you know, look, Richard Blum, we don't have to pay the same as you do in private industry. We're the University of California. We will get prestige people because this is a great university. I think that's a strong argument to make.
Well, let's move on from universities and smart people and talk about national politics. In the most recent elections, we saw the GOP triumphant in Congress, performing at the high end of expectations or even beyond it, depending who you're listening to. Scott, what do we know so far about how the Republicans are likely to govern with their power or try to govern with their power or to exercise the power that they have?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting to see how they're reacting to the president's executive order on immigration. There was, of course, fury, and we had the speaker, Boehner, saying he's going to fight it tooth and nail. But at the same time, I think they realize they're probably not going to be able to undo it. And I think they're reluctant to try to undo it through the budget because they don't really control that part of the budget anyway. And so the question is, will the governing Republicans sort of step forward and try to get something done to show they can govern Because if you're going to run for president and hope to win in 2016, I think you have to do, you know, you have to do more than say no. And I think Boehner and even McConnell both want to be significant leaders in their party. They don't want to just preside over being the party of no. Now, what are they going to do with that? I don't know. I think with immigration reform, it would be interesting to see what would happen. I don't know what you all think about this, but you know, stopping short of citizenship, a path to citizenship, and talking about legal status, you know, just allowing people to stay in the country, acknowledge we're not going to deport 11 million people, stopping short, and then putting that on the president's desk. That could be an interesting kind of play, whether they'll do that or have the votes for that, you know, and whether Obama would sign it, you know, I don't know.
You know, I think Obama's executive order did one thing, which was to fire up the Republicans. You know, the latest polls show there has been an increase now in people who are opposed to a path to citizenship. It has brought the Republicans together, and that's a danger for him. On the other hand, the Republicans have a tightrope to walk because we know how demographics, we know the demographic shifts in this country and where they're going. And, you know, there were two networks that carried the president's speech live. That was Telemundo and Univision. And they cut into the Latin Grammy Awards to do that. I mean, these issues are so important to Hispanic voters, and the Republicans cannot alienate these voters. At the same time, you know, you've got some flamethrowers up there who are already talking about by December 11th, they have to pass legislation or the government can shut down December 11th. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. But then there's other deadlines coming up in February and March. For government shutdowns, and if voters keep hearing about this kind of, you know, action, Republicans are playing with fire on that.
I think, though, that the, you know, the notion that what happened in California to the Republican Party is, you know, at risk of to the Republicans of happening nationally because of the demographic changes, I think it's not quite fully, I think it's overstated. You know, if you look at Latino, Hispanic voters in Texas and Florida, they're different than Latinos here. Even Latinos in the Central Valley are different than the ones on the coast. And, you know, you don't need to get 60% if you're the Republican nominee for president of the Latino vote. You need 40%.
Republicans have a province called women.
Well, although they didn't have it in this last election. But
no, but in presidential elections they do, and Obama carried women by, I think, 12% and lost men by 9%, which was a 21% gender gap, which is the largest gender gap since Reagan, I think, in 1984. But I look at the president's executive action. Every time I call it executive order, somebody calls me up and yells at me. It's not an executive order. It's an executive action because he didn't formally sign a document, I guess. I see the president laying a very clever trap for Republicans in this regard. Republicans can howl at the moon about what he's done and talk about the unconstitutionality and go completely berserk and want to do impeachment and all sorts of crazy things. And here they are talking about the rule of law on one side, and there's a president on the other side saying, I'm doing this because I care about parents of children in this country. I'm trying to protect these people and extend the umbrella. You can talk about the legality of what he did, and it's a fascinating debate to talk about it, but the fact is you're in a public relations fight with the President of the United States over a bunch of people who he's trying to protect. And if you're a Republican, you will lose this debate each and every time. That's why I think you see cooler heads prevailing in the Republican circles. And I think the strategy is this moving forward for Republicans. You let Ted Cruz do whatever he wants to on a given day. And, I mean, Cruz so far has talked impeachment. He's talked government shutdown. He's talked about passing a law to impeach federal judges who overturn same-sex marriage bans. I mean, he does not lack for ideas. But you just leave him there out on his own, let him do what you want to, and you just focus on the issue of governing. Scott's right. Republicans need about 40% of the Latino vote, but they need to work on their brand in general, and they work on their brand by being a productive force in Washington. Maybe 9/10 of the things they send to the president he vetoes, but they at least cannot be accused of being the party of no by being productive with what they have in Congress right now. It's the great irony that we have in politics right now. From 1954 to 1994, Republicans were a presidential party, and Democrats were solely a congressional party. And then two very dysfunctional men from the South named Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton flipped this arrangement. And Bill Clinton found a way to win presidential elections, and Newt Gingrich found a way to win congressional elections. When Barack Obama leaves office, Democrats will have held the White House for 16 of the last 24 years. Republicans will have held Congress for 18 of the last, one chamber of Congress for 18 of the last 24 years. The problem with being a congressional party is twofold. Number one, you don't have readily apparent leadership outside of the two leaders. But secondly, you're not really in a position to do great grand things because you're at all times blocking the president's agenda. So the irony here is that in 2015, in order to win the White House in 2016, Republicans in 2015 have to find a way to use their powers available in Congress to be seen less as a party merely of Congress.
I will say that I think, you know, Obama won, got reelected in part because the party had such a huge advantage with their get out the vote operation, the use of technology, big data, and Republicans are beginning to fix that. You know, whether they can fix it in time for 2016 remains to be seen. But I think they have learned from some of the, they learned some lessons from some of the mistakes in the past. And I think that the Democrats, it was a little bit of whistling past the graveyard. You know, when they look at, they say, well, the demographics, you know, we've got a lock on the White House. I mean, that just really isn't
well,
true.
Well, we know that Mitt Romney won 9 out of 10 of the white votes in the last election. And Obama won, nine out of 10 of white voters. No, Romney.
Men.
Romney.
Men.
Of the white. But Obama won, and Obama won 8 out of 10 of the, when we talk about the demographic shift, many of Romney's voters were white voters, older white voters.
9 out of 10
of his voters is what I'm saying. I'm sorry.
Okay.
And for Obama, it was 8 out of 10 of his voters were minority voters. So that is the demographic sort of difference. And that's sort of this kind of split is kind of what we're saying about the issue with Ferguson, that the racial divide is still there, these parties are going to have to deal with this.
The problem for Hillary Clinton long term, and then if you look at this, if you think of the Obama coalition as a legged stool, what are those legs on the stool? There are white liberals, there are African Americans, Latinos, and millennials. So let's assume that white liberals come around to Hillary, although historically she and her husband have had problematic relations with that part of the party because Bill Clinton was all about moving the party toward the center. Millennials, she's 69 years old in 2016. She's not been Democrats' love young candidate. She'll be the oldest nominee since, I think, James Buchanan in 1856. Never good to be in the same sentence as James Buchanan, by the way. Then there's Latinos, which is kind of complicated because we'll have to see where she comes out on immigration. And then African Americans. I haven't heard much about her in the Ferguson situation, for example. So in order for her to, she has to bump the same vote that Obama did, and it's not readily apparent if that vote is automatically transferable.
We did want to talk a bit about Ferguson, so why don't we go right into that. And I this is not to get into the whole issue of Ferguson. We can't solve that in several minutes. But obviously we're a political roundtable, so I wanted to talk about how the candidates, or not the candidates, but the political leaders are doing in handling this issue. President Obama, I understand, is due to meet with several members of leaders of the Ferguson. He did today. Do we know what he said? What should he have said?
He said he's greatly concerned. He announced a task force, which is not quite a punt, but anytime you're a task force or commission, it begs the question of what are you going to do? The one disheartening fact was that Al Sharpton was in the room. I'm not sure why you invite Al Sharpton. He's part of the problem, not of the solution, by my estimation. But we'll see if 6 months from now that this task force of various concerned citizens comes up with some solutions, because that's what we need here. We need fixes. One thought which I had coming up here was, what would Milton Friedman do? Milton Friedman, a San Franciscan economist who actually has some rather interesting thoughts about race relations and the plight of inner cities. What Milton Friedman would tell you is it's time to end the war on drugs, plain and simple. And why is that? Because there are a lot of reasons why African Americans are in the position they are right now, one of which is they have been at the victims of this war on drug. And maybe you and I would have the same opinion toward police if our doors are being kicked down and our kids are being arrested for carrying a couple grams of crack on us. So these are the sort of bold things which perhaps a leader can do. One person who's talking about this, by the way, is Rand Paul, who's been to Berkeley and has been speaking at Howard and other historically black colleges and actually has some pretty provocative thoughts on this.
He
is, yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, it's interesting. I mean, Obama, obviously, there's no more loyal constituency for him than African Americans. I mean, he's a historic figure and all. But African Americans haven't, in many ways, done so well under this president. Their unemployment rates are lagging behind. They haven't benefited from the recovery. We're seeing these huge disparities in income, and they're on the short end of that. So you do get the sense with the president that he is just of two minds on these things. He wants to be out in front. You know, I think there are a lot of people who wanted him to go to Ferguson. At the same time, the Department of Justice is investigating whether there's some kind of a federal intervention there. What I really want to do is read Barack Obama's book when he leaves office, because I really do think that there's a lot he has to say about race and race relations, but I just don't think he's going to say most of it while he's president.
I think this, as Bill said, I think the issue of the disparity in sentencing has now come to a national a tipping point. We can now see this, and the issue of policing, community policing, and policing and the racial divide. Look, in Oakland, we had Oscar Grant. We've seen so many of these cases now that this story hit a nerve all over the country, I think. And in the aftermath, I think what the disturbing thing was to watch in my city just these violent riots, I wouldn't call them riots, but demonstrations, and sort of the excuse to destroy local neighborhoods,
I think. This is why it's such a zero-sum game as an argument, because people become outraged by what happens in that town in Missouri, and then people become outraged, similarly opposite people become outraged when they see the 3 days of rioting and vandalism going on.
If you look at the demographics of who's on the streets, it was very diverse. It was very young, and there were a lot of white folks, and you know there were African Americans, but you know by no means, even in Ferguson, you know it was a very diverse crowd, and so I think you're right. It struck a nerve, but how many times? It seems to me that that's happened so many times before.
And it is, and it raises the question, are these people out there because they're really upset about Ferguson, or are these just professional, not professional, but just these people who do this out of Ferguson or Oscar Grant or WTO or whatever?
I think the vast majority of them are genuine. I think it doesn't take many knuckleheads to, you know, screw things up, and I think there are professional provocateurs, and we saw that in San Francisco, too, over the weekend. So, but I do think that most of that feeling is genuine, but how do you channel it into policy?
Right about Barack Obama, you know, Bill Clinton was knocked after he left office for missing out on some issues and ducking some things, the most prominent one being Rwanda and genocide, for example. And so he has made it a point in his post-presidency to be seen active on these sorts of issues. And I think Obama, who does have sensitive political radar, will realize in his post-presidential years that, you know, I need to step up my game, and I suspect that he'll probably start some initiative or do something out of his library talking about race relations.
Yeah. Briefly then, we talked President Obama's handling of Ferguson issues. We've seen disturbances locally, so what do you think of what Mayor Lee has done, what incoming new Oakland's new mayor have done? Are they getting on top of this issue, or are they kind of just letting the police forces deal with it? Go ahead.
I mean, I don't think Ed Lee had much. I don't think it was as big a story here. I mean, to me, Ed Lee, the story of what's happening in San Francisco is much more about affordable housing, affordability more generally, and you know, I think Mayor Kwan in Oakland has just had a very difficult relationship with the police department, and I think if, you know, mayors learn one thing is that you need to have a good relationship with the police department. I think there were a lot of people in Oakland in the police department who would have liked perhaps to take a firmer hand with some of the protesters, but they were just sort of told to hold off. I think that attitude exists here in San Francisco as well, but I think Greg Suhr, the police chief, has done a really nice job of sort of getting into the community. He really is in the community all the time.
Isn't that the key? I mean, that's what we learned from Ferguson is you can't have a police department that is not reflective in any way of the citizenry.
Yeah, and is that one of the top things that needs to be addressed? Yeah. More hires?
I think both in Oakland and San Francisco, a lot of strides have been made in that front.
Well, very good.
Just as a quick aside, we didn't see anything in San Jose. San Jose is such a different place from here. Yeah. It really is. I you know, I asked Sam Liccardo about that, the new mayor. And, you know, it's just a cool, it's more, you know, the tech community, the politics are much cooler. It's much more kind of cerebral in a way. They just, that passion just doesn't erupt down there.
Nobody around downtown.
Yeah, there's no one around. So.
They're not rioting in Wasilla, Alaska either. As usual, we have more questions than I've been able to work into our conversation here, and I apologize for not being able to get to more of them. Very good questions. But it's time for our news quiz. So here's what we do for those of you who have not done our news quiz before. I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll call on the first person I see. You know, shout out the answer if I do that. And if you get it correct, you get a prize. No, but Colette will deliver some chocolate. So, first question. Friday was Black Friday. Saturday was Small Business Saturday. And, of course, today is Cyber Monday. What is tomorrow? The raise the hand part was really key. Ma'am, actually, I saw, you're in the first. Giving Tuesday, that's right. I should just, throw chocolate to everyone who got that one right. Okay, next question. Where did Georgia police officers find a 13-year-old boy who had been missing for 4 years? Right here.
Behind a wall,
that's right, in his father and stepmother's house. So he's been reunited with his... Yeah. Okay, next question. On Sunday, there's Chicago's Magnificent Mile, we know that, and it was matched by an unmagnificent mile in that city. What stretched for more than a mile? Did you see this story? And I'm sorry, I saw a gentleman back there. That's right, at the airport security line at Midway Airport. Oh, that's not the worst part. It said it was Midway. I mean, it's not even a good airport. Okay. A Republican congressional staffer apologized and resigned after criticizing the attire of whom, sir, in the red? Obama's daughters, what they were wearing at the turkey pardoning ceremony. An Egyptian court dropped all charges against whom? Ma'am, in the back. Former President Hosni Mubarak. Did you see who that was, Colette? What dropped 11% this holiday season?
Black Friday sales.
Black Friday sales, right here in front. And House Speaker John Boehner is reportedly spreading the word that the Republicans won't try to do what to the government? We're just going to move on to the next question. He said he doesn't want to shut it down. Actually, and this goes back to what one of the panelists said, he and Mitch McConnell do not want to just be caretakers or office holders. They actually want to have a bit better of a reputation than being the shutdown people. So we'll see how that works out. Okay, here's one. Why does Sony Pictures think it might be being targeted by North Korean cyber hackers? Man. Sony Pictures is releasing a movie in which Seth Rogen and James Franco are recruited to assassinate North Korea's leader. It's a comedy, we think, not a documentary. How many more do we have in there?
Four.
Oh my goodness. Here's some good news. We need some of that. The World Health Organization says it has largely met its goals that it set for the control of what? Way in back there. Sorry? No, I'm sorry. Right there in the... Sir? Ebola, that's correct. Yeah, well, in two of the three countries in Africa where that's been hard hit, they say they've done well. Okay. President Obama is preparing an executive... I was going to say order, but probably an executive action that would increase federal oversight for programs that do what with local law enforcement departments? Way in the back. He does, but that's not actually what he's looking for here. That's another issue. And if you don't mind, I'm going to go with someone who hasn't answered yet.
Okay.
Sir. Right. A lot of what has come out of the Ferguson issue is a recognition of just how much of this surplus military equipment has gone into local police departments. And he wants to increase the oversight of that. I believe we have two more prizes, Colette? Two more, okay. Germany's government is considering banning what types of emails? Ma'am in the blue.
Google?
No.
Email from bosses.
A little bit more.
Are work-related emails to people on their
personal... Right. Off work hour, they would want to ban emails outside of work hours. And finally... And actually, someone already answered that question, so I'm going to... Pope Francis just wrapped up a 3-day visit to what country? We're coming up with a new question. Okay. Oh, goodness sakes. What about him? I know. You can get the chocolate if you answer their question. So, here. Oh, yeah, usually it's a little bit easier. Yeah, anyone have a question? Oh, okay. President Obama did an executive action. Do you like it when I clap right in front of the microphone? One of his other executive actions involved another country. What did he do? And I saw your hand first, sir. Did he? Yeah. That's not what I'm thinking of, but I'm worried that there was maybe also that. Does anyone know? Was it? With the climate deal, right?
With respect to the climate.
Okay. It was. Okay, very good. I just learned something today. Thank you very much. We're going to put the two of you in a room, and you're going to fight for the chocolate. Both of you, why don't you come up afterward? We'll get something for you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you to our panelists, Bill Whalen, Scott Schaefer, Carla Marinucci. Thanks to all of you here and listening online and watching TV. Have a great week.